Frank Granato!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a brainer.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
All right, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Hello, Brock. I'm coming to you from the COVID cave in my basement. That's where I just set up shop down here, and I'm sorry I was unable to go last week. You would not have wanted me to attempt to do any form of podcast, radio, anything. I was essentially asleep. I was like Wendell. I slept 23 hours a day for a few days.
A dog's life. It was a dog's life. Yeah, I'm very curious here. It will be very, and people, if you want to, you know, pull out your ticker, you can start to do so, of what's going to get mentioned more. Salk's COVID and vasectomy or my USFL and Sitka. Those will probably, you know, and not that I'm trying to frame you or me or life experiences of the last 5 weeks differently. But yes, you're in the COVID cave post-vasectomy surgery, and I am in Sitka, Alaska after being in Birmingham for 5 weeks or weekends anyway. So yes, ready to get home though. I am ready to get
home. You're hitting the major metropolises of the world.
Yes.
Making sure you're dotting every I and crossing every T with all of the big metropolises that the U.S.
Wasn't that a song from Birmingham, Phoenix, to Arizona, all the way to Tacoma, from Birmingham to Sitka, Alaska. Wasn't that part of it?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, something
Steve
like
Miller
that.
Band, I believe.
Right.
So, Brock, it seems now to me very clear. The Seahawks are going to get Baker Mayfield. Right? Isn't that the only way this can go down? I mean, Tim Hasselbeck said it this week, and I played that sound a whole bunch of times on the show on Wednesday or Thursday. It as you look at it, this idea that Geno Smith is going to start the season as the Seahawks' starting quarterback, it just doesn't make any sense. Not for a team that refuses to say that they're tanking, a team that will never use the phrase rebuilding, a coach who says that he's going to compete every day, a team that made every effort to go out and get Deshaun Watson as soon as they gave up on Russell Wilson. It just doesn't make any sense that after all of that, the fallback option would be Geno Smith, what with Baker Mayfield, former first overall pick who brought the Browns of all teams to the playoffs, sitting out there and potentially available. It just doesn't make any sense.
I know you've been in your COVID case or cave, and I know, you know, logic sometimes comes in and out in a fog. Why do you not mention the name? You just went for a minute. You mentioned two names. Why is there something in your psyche that just will not mention the name Drew Timmy? I mean, Drew Lock.
Drew Timmy.
He's coming back to Gonzaga for a fourth year. Did you see that news? Okay.
Yes, I did. Is there Why something am I not in your, mentioning Drew
yes,
Lock?
Yes. Is there something?
Only because in talking to Brady Henderson this week, he said that it's Drew Lock's Geno's job to lose. That unless Drew Lock squarely beats him out, he thinks tie goes to Geno Smith. And Pete has consistently said, you know, we like Geno, we like what he did, and he's our starter, and, you know, they're going to have to wrestle the job away from him, etc. And then talking to Bump, he was like, hey, I was out of practice, and sure enough, like, you know, that was the guy that was sort of leading the way. Uh-huh. So, you know, I'm just trying to, does it make any sense to me? No. But, you know, that's where the direction seems to be right now.
Well, I think they are doing everything in their power to take any pressure and any expectations off of Drew Lock. But if you're gonna have this conversation, Baker Mayfield or has got to be Geno or Drew. I mean, you just have to include him in this because to your belief, and it may be Machiavellian, and you may be absolutely right here in a month of training camp, and Baker Mayfield may be the logical one. They may have known this for months on end. They may just be doing this purely and rightfully from a business perspective to make sure Cleveland eats all $18.6 million of that guaranteed fifth-year option they picked up. But I also think you have to consider that the Seahawks are playing this as far as Drew Lock goes. Hey, yeah, it's Geno. It's Geno's team. Hey, man, Geno knows it. Geno knows the system. Geno's a year up. Because we want to take every bit of expectation off of Drew Lock and let his physical gifts. I checked in with some folks over there, and they love the way he's handling all of the workload mentally. I think that was the first thing they needed needed to see, because it was a question mark coming out of college, because his system in college was as simple as the eighth grade system down there with the Puyallup Rough Riders. I mean, it was rudimentary, to say the least, in the passing game. So they have been thoroughly impressed with him mentally and handling the playbook and leadership-wise. His arm talent is absolutely there. They're seeing all of that. For them, this is all about his scar tissue. For them, it's all about, yeah, in big moments, right, when it's actually matters, is he going to be able to make the decisions and protect the football and do some of the things over the last 2 years he did not do
in Denver? And telling the world that they're going to go with Geno Smith is helping? That helps.
Oh, I think they're just telling the Brady Hendersons and Pete's out there doing what Pete always does, and we'll get into this a little bit as well. I know today and in this podcast with some of the Neil sound over the week as well. Pete is the master protector of everything, of his team, of his image, of his players, even of his assistant coaches, and in Ken Norton in particular, who was horrendous, still protected him. So I think this is Pete's just protection mechanism to make sure, Drew, we told you, we liked you, you're going to come in here, you're going to compete. We are not going to ramp up any expectations. We're not going to put you in a position, hey, you're the starter, you're the guy, you got to come in here and compete and earn it. And that's the spot, I think, psychologically and just the way that Pete operates that he wants to put Drew into. So I think he's playing that just as much as the Seahawks are playing the, oh, yeah, we're not even sniffing on Baker.
All right, well, fine, I'll believe that. Because at the end of the day, it's really hard for me to believe that Geno Smith is going to be anybody's choice to be a starting quarterback. And that, quite frankly, Brock, if it comes down to Drew Lock and Geno Smith and Geno earns the job, that Drew should retire.
No, he shouldn't. He should try to play as long as he possibly can.
All right, fine.
Okay.
But that he knows
and he can
that
look
point.
At Matt Schaub and Charlie That's Whitehurst true. And all That's the names true. You want to bring up for Ghost Kitchen that haunt me. Go ahead and bring up all of those guys. And no, he should absolutely try to extend this thing as long as he possibly can.
All right,
but yes,
enough.
if he gets beat out by Geno, that's not what you're looking for.
No, at that point.
That would not be good for the career.
That would be pretty much the end of Drew Lock as a potential starter in the NFL. I mean, he then becomes, as you just said, sort of on that backup train of like, hey, who else is around? Hey, you could grab Drew Lock, yep. right? I mean, like that yep. sort of, and frankly, that's what Geno Smith was at when the Seahawks brought him in. Right? A guy who had failed out in New York with the Giants, failed out in LA with the Chargers. Like, it was done. It was like, okay, he's mm-hmm. sort of gone down
he's
that
a backup.
Road.
He is a backup QB.
In that circuit. Well, why are they now considering this new, now career backup circuit quarterback to be the starting quarterback? It just doesn't mm-hmm. it just doesn't quite make sense.
Okay, so let's spin it then to the real conversation here, because you and I have talked Geno and Drew an awful lot, and we'll probably continue to do so, but then let's talk about the real conversation, and that is Baker Mayfield. Mm-hmm. Did the rest of the league just in through this offseason look at Baker Mayfield and say, yep, I've got 4 years of Baker Mayfield, three of which, by the way, look like Geno Smith. Three of which, of those 4 years, the numbers are 66 touchdowns to 48 interceptions. Three of the 4 years, and that's not like that's this year, obviously a tougher rookie year, a little trending better his next year, but he was in three of his 4 years, he could not take care of the football, could not win on the road. And then obviously 2020 Baker was unbelievable, 12-6, wins a playoff game, beats Pittsburgh, 26 touchdowns to 8 interceptions, finally a 3-1 and a 95.5 rating. But even for his career in those 4 years, a rating around 90, 89, which in this league today is nowhere near good starter. I mean, that's backup QB stuff. And is the market saying to Baker, yeah, man, you may think you're a franchise guy, but your own team did not. And went out and got a guy who just had another allegation, his 23rd against him, and guaranteed him so much money. Your own team, who you took to the playoffs, decided to do that because they look at the body of work through 60 games and see in three of those 4 years, 66 touchdowns, Salk, to 48. 8 interceptions.
Yeah, I don't know. I understand some of that, but I also think that you could write a different script on what's happened with Baker in the course of his career, right? I mean, rookie year, team's still sort of a mess, right? They're coming off being the worst team in the league, which is how they got him. You know, that 27 to 14 touchdown interception ratio is not great, but it's not horrible considering. The next year, obviously, there's an issue. So throws 21 interceptions. I'm still not really.
By the way, three of which against the Seahawks that year in a loss.
How did anybody throw 21 interceptions in the modern game of football? I mean, that's a.
How did anybody throw three picks against the Seahawks? They don't intercept the ball.
I know.
That may have been I have no idea, but in Ken Norton's tenure, that may have been the most.
Yeah.
Maybe was that still Norton in 19? I think it was. Yeah. His first year. Yeah. That's probably the most picks they had in any single game.
That's probably
so.
True.
Against the Seahawks,
but yep. He shows the ability the next year. As you said, you know, they go 11-5. He takes the Browns, who hadn't been in the playoffs since returning to the NFL, to the playoffs. Right, has a great year. Shows everything he's capable of when he's healthy and in the right system, etc. With a run game, which are all things the Seahawks would be providing for him if he were to show up here. He'd end up with a very good running game. I'm not saying he's a great quarterback. This is not an argument about whether or not Baker Mayfield is the future starter for the Seahawks forever and ever. I don't think that. But if you're asking me who's a better quarterback right now, Baker Mayfield or either Drew Locke or Geno Smith, I don't even think it's a debate. Of course it's Baker Mayfield.
Okay, and I would agree with that in this conversation. But why after 2020, before I got two questions and two follow-ups to that, but why? Why after that 2020 season, doing everything that you just said, turning the corner, right? 26 touchdowns to 8 interceptions, going to the playoffs, winning a playoff game against Pittsburgh, neutralizing your opponent, right? Doing everything that he said he was going to do when he got drafted. Everything that you loved, the sound that we played, right? After the draft, that you know, he's one of the few guys coming out of college that you actually really liked. And we're like, man, I love this dude's just stones and his charisma and his willingness and want to go to Cleveland and make him believe Cleveland and turn it around. He did all of that. Mm-hmm. Why did he not get an extension then? If you're the rest of the league, I guarantee you they're thinking about that. They're looking at it. It's the same head coach, pretty stable guy, right? Owner's got plenty of cash on hand. Why didn't they do the deal then?
Yeah.
Why not go and get that done? So that to me is a little bit concerning, but then even more concerning, okay? Even more concerning, or the question that you really have to answer then, Salk, is this. Because I'm sure Seahawks fans listening to this thinking the same exact thing. Do you want Baker for a year? Do you want to go 9-8? Would it benefit you to be in that middle of the pack and not be a team, not tanking, but letting Drew Locke, you know, fail, you know, learning who he is and who he isn't, and go down that road and let them play and let it go that road instead of being, okay, yeah, maybe with Baker we're an 8-9 team or a 9-8 team. Without him, maybe you're a 5 or 6 win team right now. Probably the way most people are looking at him. Do you want that? Does that benefit you as an organization over the long term?
This is a separate question. That's a question about what I would do and what I want. To me, this is the first question is what are the Seahawks going to do and what do they want? Because regardless of my answer to that question, Brock, whether I'm okay with losing more games in order to build a long-term success story, that's not Pete Carroll. That's not the team that tried to get Deshaun Watson as soon as Russell Wilson left. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's not the way Pete thinks about the world. Okay. So regardless of what I would do, and you know, I would have been a proud suck for Lucker and all of that. Like, I you know me.
Yep.
I think that being in the middle is the worst place you can be. So
in between. Can't be in between.
I don't want to be in between.
Nope.
But Pete's made it pretty clear that he's okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Lose. Nope, he wants to compete and at this stage and everything else, and he believes in his people more than anybody else does, and he's going to give them kind of every last opportunity to make something of them. I just and I also wonder aloud at this as well, and that is, oh, it's just easy, just bring him in for a year. But what have you always said about that quarterback, right? In drafting a quarterback and making that decision with the quarterback. Right, and you bring him in, and I don't know what it would be for 18, 8.5. Does that's, well, Cleveland will probably eat some of it, but
All does that I mean, set, that's the does, whole idea here.
Does that set you back in the process moving forward? You know, I think that ultimately is the biggest question of all. I like a lot of Baker's competitiveness. I think it would mix really well with the head coach. Mm-hmm. I think those two are aligned very similar. Got a chip on their shoulder. Baker has a real big chip and now a boulder on his shoulder that is the left one repaired, which also probably played a role in his difficulties of the 2021 season.
Right.
But ultimately, I mean, is he the guy that you want to, and you say, oh, you don't really have to commit. No, you're going to give him that opportunity, right? You're going to give him the same opportunity. I don't know what the deal would look like or how much guaranteed money, but do you want to go down that road and make that commitment to Baker Mayfield?
I've gone back and forth on this about 100 times. Honestly, I've gone back and forth on it 100 times because I find myself very conflicted on answering this question, Brock.
Yep.
And for all of the reasons that you just brought up, I don't think Baker's perfect or anything close to it. I don't think that if it was a matter of needing to commit to large dollars, there's no way I would be willing to do that for Baker Mayfield. As you said, just based on the numbers, based on the fact that other teams have not committed to him, he's made it pretty clear that he's not somebody that you want to commit to as a franchise quarterback at this stage in his career. But I don't know whether that's actually what you're being asked to do. And if that's the case, am I willing to go after Baker Mayfield to be better than, you know, terrible? Maybe?
But the challenge with that, and you know, the challenge with that is I said, okay, you go 9-8, 8-9, play some good games, still turns it over, throws 25 touchdowns, but throws 13 picks, and it's just kind of that guy.
What
and
if
then
he doesn't
you say,
do that? What if you look at it and say, Brock, the NFC is not a very great conference right now. The rest of your division, as you've pointed out, has all kinds of different issues, and each one of those teams has its own issue that is worth discussing, and you've actually got, outside of the quarterback spot, a running game that you really are excited about with a couple of new tackles that you really like, and you had some success last year even in the running game, and say what you want about your issues and defensively, but it sure sounds like you've at least cleaned up some of the coaching problems there. Mm-hmm. And so is it impossible that by playing Seahawks defense and playing Seahawks brand of football that you actually are a lot more competitive and maybe make the playoffs this year? If that's the case, is it worth making the playoffs even if you don't win the Super Bowl with Baker Mayfield? It probably is.
But then you got to commit to him. I mean, if Baker Mayfield takes you to the playoffs and does all of those things, and even to mention the word playoffs coming into this season of expectations where they're at 5 or 5.5 wins right now, and all of a sudden he makes you that, you're going to commit to him.
Why do I have
you're going to commit that? To him.
No, maybe I'm not. I'm not committing to commit to him.
Well, you're not going to draft a top 10 QB. You're not going to draft top 5 QB. You're not going to be in a position to get. You're not going to be in a position to get one of those guys.
Maybe the Broncos stink.
Oh.
Maybe the Broncos are terrible.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be terrible.
No.
No, I don't think they'll be terrible. I think they're going to be pretty good, but they are in a tougher division. They are in a tougher conference. I understand all of that. But yeah, this is where the conundrum is, right? Because in fantasy football, you sign Baker Mayfield. In fantasy football, you look at your team, you look at your roster, and he's going to make you better, and he's going to be more productive. And he is a younger guy, even though he is beat up. And even though he has had some rough years and some rough play, he helped turn that place around. And this is the conundrum. You bring him in here, you are going to be a better team. You're in the win-loss column, I think you're going to be a better team. But in the long haul, is that good for you? And most importantly, at that position, do you believe in that guy? I mean, do you believe that Baker Mayfield is your guy?
But I
think that's what John...
Does this give you an opportunity to find out?
Yes.
I mean, like, you don't have to answer that right now. That's sort of the one advantage to this situation, because I don't know that I could answer is, do I believe that? No, of course not. How could you? He hasn't given you the reason to believe that right now.
Well, but he did in 2020. I mean, if we had this conversation after 2020, right? No, not right now, and I don't think they're answering it right now, and it's what I've been pretty consistent with you over the last month or so. I think that they are going to take in for the next few weeks all of the information they possibly can on their roster, on their team, be honest and be objective with where they're at. They still have cap space to spend if they want to. There's still free agents out on the market, some that have played and started a bunch of games for you here in Seattle, on the O-line in particular. So I think they use the next 2 to 3 weeks for sure to do and continue to do their own evaluation, and then, you know, I think Cleveland's playing chicken, and I think they and their brass are just playing chicken, and they're going to, you know, and Baker's not showing up to their OTAs, obviously, he's not showing up to anything there. They want to get some team to be on some of the hook for that $18.6 million guaranteed.
Yeah.
But I, as you said, man, this is just an in-betweener. This is just one that you can write the script and write the narrative on both sides of it pretty clearly.
Yeah, I like the debate, obviously, because of that. But in terms of answering it, I feel bad that I've kind of, you know, changed my mind 100 times on what I would do.
You get a sense for what the people think. You get a sense for callers, for texters, for some of the. You get a sense that they would want Baker Mayfield.
I think at the end of the day, most people would rather win than not win.
Because winning begets a little bit more winning. Winning makes the environment better for everybody. Winning develops your players. Winning puts you in more pressurized situations where you do really get to evaluate who you are and what you are.
All of those things, but also just winning is more fun than not winning.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean it's necessarily the right thing to do, but I think for the most part, people believe fairly that winning is better than not winning.
Yep.
And who's going to win more games, Baker Mayfield or either of the other two guys?
Yep.
Probably Baker Mayfield.
Yep.
So what do I think more people want to do? I think more people would probably want to sign Baker because winning is more fun than not winning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if it's not always the right thing to do.
Yeah, and he's the name.
Long-term.
Yep, and he's the name, and he's the one that people know, and he's the one they're more comfortable with, and he's the one that just, I mean, seriously, think how ridiculous this conversation is right now. Is the sun is just shining through this beautiful office here in Sitka, Alaska. As you're coming out of the
Sitka, interesting.
Yeah, I actually did. I tell you that.
Yeah,
I'm in Sitka.
Okay.
Think how ludicrous and ridiculous this conversation were to sound if we said after the 2020 season, not 2010 season, 2015, 2020 season, just a year and a half ago, after Cleveland goes to the playoffs, if I said to you, "Hey, Salk, we're going to have a conversation in June of 2022, and it's going to be about Baker Mayfield. And it's going to be whether or not the Seahawks should sign him, because Cleveland dumped him. And oh, by the way, the Seahawks also dumped Russell Wilson." I mean, that is the fickle nature of this position as well. That is why these conversations at this most important position in sports also kind of make you pull your hair out, because these things can change, and in Baker's case, change in a year. From going from the savior of that organization, the face of that organization, in some ways the face of the NFL, as far as his commercials and his popularity and everything. I mean, incredible, right? After the 2020 season, he was trending with Mahomes, and obviously Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, that, you know, super talented guys in his own draft class. But he was trending right there as one of the marquee quarterbacks in all the NFL. And a year later, and it's a conundrum. Then you and I are in between on whether or not it is better for the Seahawks to bring Baker Mayfield in. It's remarkable.
It is crazy, but, you know, and sometimes when it goes. See Newton, Cam, right? I mean, like, I would not have necessarily predicted he would have fallen as far as.
See Carson Wentz. See Jared Goff. See guys that even got extensions. Baker didn't even get his big money from his team. Those two guys did.
I mean,
see the plight of young QBs. Huh?
They never should have paid Carson Wentz. That was never a good idea.
Should they have paid Jared Goff? Took him to the Super Bowl. Yeah.
No, they probably shouldn't have done that either. Right?
Nope. Pretty wild.
Yeah, it is amazing how quickly things can change for some of these guys. And in Baker's case, I don't know firmly what I would do, Brock, but just trying to read the tea leaves, it's still just hard for me to believe that at the end of the day, Pete Carroll's going to look at this and say, "I'd rather go with the two guys in my room than Baker Mayfield." And,
correct.
And that he won't see just the flat-out talent level that Baker has that made him the number one overall pick just a couple of years ago and say, "I can do more with that talent than whatever else."
Yep.
Right? I just
in his competitive DNA and makeup, he is never looking for the long term. He is not looking at any, and he shouldn't be. And that's the way Pete is wired, and that's not his job to do. That is John Schneider's job to do. That is Jody Allen's job to do. That is others' jobs to do, is to look at the big picture, to look at the long play. It is Pete's job to go win and compete every minute of every hour of every day on that practice field right now and into training camp and everything else.
How is it not obvious? Of course I want the guy with more talent. So my guess is that that's where this ends up. It has been an interesting week or two here for the Seahawks. I mean, first, I was kind of out of it, but you dealt with the...
What do you mean? With your vasectomy or your COVID?
My COVID.
Oh, okay.
But you dealt with the Jody Allen story and whether or not they're getting ready to sell the Seahawks.
Yeah, I'm not buying that. I know the Blazers are an entirely different deal. I know that John Cazano's a very good reporter. He is dialed in, as you could possibly be, in that market down in Oregon and with those Blazers and the dysfunction and the mess of all of that stuff. But, you know, I also know that there is a pretty significant clause that will require that trust to pay back hundreds of millions of dollars. And there is no way in the fiduciary interest of that trust that they are going to do that until that ends. And I don't remember, excuse me, if that's 25 or 26. I think it is, but we're still years away from that happening. So I don't see any just urgency to that. And beyond that, I think Jody Allen is loving what she's doing now. I think she's loving running this organization and wants in every way to honor her brother and to do it well and to get back to winning. And, you know, they made a significant decision and they went with Pete and John and not Russell Wilson. And she wants to, I think, empower those guys and give them every chance to turn it around and win.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. But it is really interesting what these next, let's call it, 5 years or so are going to look like in this city. I mean, we got rumors of Sonics, right, just in the last couple of days that announcement is coming sooner rather than later. The Mariners building around Julio Rodriguez and some of the changes there. New quarterback for the Seahawks. It's amazing how quickly things can kind of change.
I mean, the Huskies are going to be playing for national titles on the football field. Sounders will continue to do what they're doing. Sue Bird, eventually, when she's 56, is going to retire. I mean, it's going to be some wild, wild times in our Seattle market, indeed. Right. And, oh, by the way, that was one story. And we hit on this a little earlier, and you kind of teased just to a degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you got the defensive players doing a little,
man.
Little
so,
talking this
so
week.
Let's talk through this a little bit. Let's spend a couple of minutes on them before we get to the Mariners. So Ryan Neal, of all people, became the second or third Seahawks defensive player to essentially crush their coaching staff. And specifically, I think this reflects on Ken Norton, because he's the one who's no longer here. But first it was Quandre Diggs, who said this in February on the Ben Baller podcast, and then it was Ryan Neal after practice this week, saying essentially, we got guys doing the wrong thing, that they're misusing the players. And it got me kind of thinking through everything we've heard and some of the accusations about this defense, and I ended up with six different major potential problems, Brock, that were going on before you even get to personnel. Before you get to personnel, there were six potential huge problems with the coaching staff in this defense. One was whether, you know, you had pass rushers rushing versus other guys, and now everyone has sort of called this out, right? We need to get the pass rushers rushing and the coverage guys in coverage and not vice versa. That's one. And we can address all of these if you want, but there was that issue.
Yeah, that one, honestly, though, that one's a little whiny. That one sounds, because how many times? Yeah, there were a few times the guys would drop off, and they'd play 8 men in coverage, and every time they it didn't work.
Brady said Mayoa was in coverage 100 times last year.
Was he really?
That was Brady's number.
Wow.
So you can say that it's overblown, and I kind of thought the same thing, but when you hear numbers like that, and when you hear player after player say it, at some point I've got to, what do you always tell me? Listen to the locker room?
Yeah.
I'm going to listen to the locker room on this one, because enough people have said it that I can't really argue against it.
Well, if that is true, and Brady's got pretty good numbers, and they got all that data in the world to look at that, and they see the number of snaps and rushing coverage, rush rate, all of it, 100, that's pretty ludicrous. That's pretty dumb. Okay, scratch that. Not as whiny as I thought it would. So data wins right there. And yes, that is a legitimate argument. Put people in the best position possible. Okay,
so there, number two. That was one. Number two would be just guys knowing their responsibilities. And we heard that from Trey Flowers during the season and a bunch of other guys that it just wasn't well communicated. They didn't have a sense as to where they were supposed to be.
Yes, and a lot of that is week to week what Pete does do within their coverage. You know, so he's not a huge mixer of fronts and other things like a Bill Belichick world is, but they definitely do mix coverage and have over the years in their zone coverage to other teams' tendencies and formations and everything else. And yeah, and the fact that they could not get on the same page with that. And how many times, how many Mondays, how many texts did your worried little grasshopper send to you saying that I'm just done? I'm watching this. I mean, the guys are more open. I mean, more, and Brady doesn't have this stat because I don't think they can track this quite yet. Though with their laser technology in these stadiums, they probably should and could. How much air, how much green grass, how much space between eligible receivers and Seahawk defenders at the last 3 years, they lead the league, and it's not even close. Mm-hmm. So yes, their inability to get on the same page, even in the most simple of their zone coverage, inexplicable.
Well,
okay, number three.
Number three would be getting young players out on the field. That there were young players. Marquise Blair maybe is a good example, but there's probably others. I know Alton Robinson's name has come up. That the
Ugo Amadi.
The player personnel department felt like they provided some players, and Ken Norton was just unwilling to play youngsters.
Yep, and that's, you know, that's the old school NFL guard. That is what Ken grew up in. Certainly is deviated with Pete because Pete forces that issue, and ultimately that burden also falls on Pete. Mm-hmm. If Ken Norton were doing that, Pete Carroll has total authority to say, I'm sorry, we're not doing this. And in fact, that was one of Pete's great strengths. It's what he did at USC to build their dynasty and be ahead of everybody else. If it was big DBs in the Legion of Boom in the NFL, what Pete Carroll did to college football in the 2000s by playing true freshmen and saying, we will play young guys in September and it will pay the biggest dividends in November, which it did at USC for a decade of dominance. That should have fallen on Pete to say, I'm sorry, Ken. I know you trust some of these older guys more, but we have to play our young people. And in some cases he did. In some cases Pete did step in the second half of 2020 and said, enough is enough. We're going to do some of these things. We're going to turn it around. He gave Ken Norton the credit to it and for it, but a lot of that was Pete, and that one also inexplicable.
All right. The next one would be some of its predictability. Just flat out, and we've heard this again from players, saying the other team knew what was coming. They were predictable.
Yep, we were a spot drop right in these zones.
Well, that's a different one. I was going to get to that one next. That's the aggressiveness issue. But this is a predictability issue with the other team knowing what was coming all the time.
Yeah, we're going to play base defense in 2020 and try to play big people that can't cover, that can't run sideline to sideline. And oh, by the way, we can't really play man. We were so good in those years, 2011 to 16, because man looked like zone and zone looked like man, and it was single high safety and it was very difficult. And we had as much confidence to play man as we did our zone. And unfortunately, with the corner play and nickel play and one of our safeties play, can't play man coverage. So it's a very predictable zone, and people did devour it.
Then you get to the type of zone they were playing, and that would be number five, and that is sort of the spot drop and vision versus what sounds like a completely new system here, where they're going to be matching up more and being more aggressive in their zone coverage.
Yep, a little matchup zone instead of just a base 2-3 zone that you can just live in and pick apart. So, yep, it's going to be a whole lot more route recognition, a whole lot more pattern reading and pattern matching, and a lot more stickiness. I sure hope in these zone coverages to see you got more speed to do so. That has been a priority the last couple years. Why Jordan Brooks was drafted where he was, because he can run. Why an undersized Cody Barton can play, because he can run. Why your draft class was one of the fastest you've drafted, because you need speed, and you need it in your division against the Rams, against Cardinals, and against the 49ers too.
Well, Brock, that's five separate coaching issues before you get to accountability, which would be number six, and we heard some of that conversation as well. And I don't know, that one to me is a little bit more nebulous, so maybe it doesn't quite belong in here, but that's five different separate but related issues. that all tell a story of a Seahawks defense that was not getting the most out of its talent.
Yeah, and as I said to you the other day when we walked through these, and even more so, gosh, as I thought about that, it is just an erosion of belief. Mm-hmm. And it was so counter and so striking to what they were before. And maybe you needed this. Maybe you needed this total erosion to make a total implosion, which is what they've done to their staff and to their scheme and to everything else. You needed this total erosion because remember what it was? It was you deal with us. Like we do what we do and you deal with us. And trying to hold on to some of that with personnel that didn't and guys ultimately that didn't believe in it because they knew, right? They knew they weren't Cam Chancellor. You know, those guys trying to play, they knew they weren't Richard Sherman, but they're still trying to, fill those roles and fill those shoes when they couldn't. And then ultimately the group, that group that was so strong, so dominant, so vocal, so many of those things in that run. It'd be an interesting exercise to look at this off the top of my head. Right, to look at the great defenses, to look at the 46 Bears and what happened in the aftermath. I bet you'll see some parallels. I bet you'll see some parallels where they tried to hang on, they tried to do some of those things, but there was such an erosion, or I think in this case too, there was such a development by others around you in your league and in your division and your opponents who knew you, right, to just, we'll take what we give you. We're not going to play into the teeth of your defense, right? We're going to adapt and we're going to change and we're going to check. We're going to do all these things, and we're going to hire a spread coach from college, and right, we're going to do these things and evolve, and you didn't. And in fact, it eroded in all of those ways you mentioned, and I think belief bigger than anything else, just an erosion of their belief and their conviction, and therefore just an implosion and such new change.
Well, so could their defense be significantly better without any real new players, although they will have some, just by changing some of these coaching issues?
It will certainly help. I think it will give and instill some confidence. I think anytime you put your players in a position, and Clint Hurt has said that, you don't even have to point to some of these podcasts. I think Clint Hurt has been very, very clear that he's going to want to attack, that he wants his guys rushing. After all, he was the D-line coach that watched Benson Mayoa drop into coverage 100 times. So that number's blown me away. That is a lot of times.
I hope I'm quoting it right. I mean, maybe
I sure hope you are. I hope it's not 10 times.
He said 100.
Okay.
I think. I've been in the COVID cave. Did I tell you I've had COVID? I've been in the COVID cave. And
you had a vasectomy too?
I did, yeah, back to back.
Did you really?
It's been a really fun May. I've really enjoyed myself over the course of the last 3 weeks or so. If you got to get out, now's the time to do it, man. Summer's coming. Get beyond the panoramic views. On the 31st floor in downtown Bellevue, Brock, I'm talking Ascend Prime Steak and Sushi.
I'm talking
providing guests with next level culinary experience heightened on the world's best steak, hand-selected premium beef selection curated by culinary team featuring prime American steaks, Angus beef, wet-aged 28 days from New York Strip to filet mignon, prime dry-aged American steaks, Angus beef dried aged for a minimum of 45 days, bone-in ribeye, all the way to the 45-ounce Seahawk chop. How about luxury Wagyu Angus crossbreed steaks from Outside Skirt Steak to Cap of Ribeye, Kurogi Pure Breed A5 Wagyu, prized A5 Wagyu filet mignon. And then you can even do more than that, Brock. The cream of the crop, the privilege to serve, the Miyazaki Prefecture A5 Wagyu, the world's best A5 Wagyu filet mignon. Ascend, one of the first restaurants in the whole U.S. to get the Japanese exclusive designated Miyazaki Prefecture A5, and it's regularly available on the menu. I was over at Ascend a couple weeks ago at a big charity function over there, which was great, and Elena was honored for a lot of the work that she's been doing with a mentoring program. It was really cool, and the food was just ridiculous. I had a whole bunch of steak tartare, and I couldn't stop going back to eat more.
Yeah. Just like a cut above.
It is. It's a cut above. You can make reservations to indulge in the Northwest's elevated steak experience. Go to ascendprime.com. You know, it's interesting, Brock, as we sort of talk through where the Mariners are at. I was kind of thinking through some of the positives and negatives this week. I had originally started, when I jumped back on the air on Tuesday, thinking of some of the positives and negatives of having COVID, because there are some positives. I mean, literally, guilt-free napping throughout an entire day. I mean, you can just, and like, no grief from my wife, nothing, just like, oh, it's fine, just stay in your cave. It's like, okay, like, you have to get DoorDash all
the
time.
Are you in the basement? Is that your cave?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in the basement cave. Yeah.
Nice.
Just kind of set up shop down here with the, you know, big blankets and just, like, sleep on the
stairs. And they just throw food down the stairs. Cecily and Avery occasionally will throw a sandwich down the stairs or something. Nice.
Yeah. You just get a little DoorDash because you're not allowed to go.
Here's your rations, Dad!
It's been great. Maybe you can get me some of that ling cod you caught.
Yeah, did I tell you I caught some good fish here?
You know, you mentioned it. So you showed me the picture of the ling cod.
Yep.
First of all, that you're right. The mouth is really what's disgusting.
It's so gross. It is so gross. The teeth, the mouth. It must. I don't know what kind of jaw it has, but it just expands because its mouth. I mean, the one I caught, they're slotted. There's only a certain size that you can keep up here in Alaska. In a lot of places, actually, Washington, the San Juan's the same thing. They try to, just for stock purposes, make sure, you know, they keep the right size, continue to breed and do everything else. And if it gets so behemoth, I mean, this thing was huge, right? This was almost 50 inches, I want to say. Yeah, long. I mean, it was so long, so huge, but it had to be over 56 inches to keep it. So I don't even know what that dinosaur would look like if we pulled it up. But yeah, huge, huge, disgusting fangs, mouth, gross. But man, is it good eating? Is it good eating? They are mean. Yeah, they're real, real mean. And that was about 450 feet. So it's a, yeah, it's a good haul up from the bottom. And they fight and they kick and scream and they get on the boat and they flop around. And yeah, they're not the nicest. They're not the nicest fish down there. And yeah, they just devour everything down there. So this is kind of probably a good segue here. I mean, the good and the bad. Like, that is the bad of it. The good of it is it tastes good, man, because it's eaten crab and shrimp and dead halibut and everything else, man. It is good, sweet tasting stuff when you can put it on your plate.
Well, there's your comp into the Mariners, which unfortunately, you know, there's probably been more bad than good. Obviously, you look at the record and you're just not where you were expecting to be or hoping to be, you know, for this season, which turned
what
into
is their record? What is it? They're 21 and 25.
Who are you asking? You're really asking me this question? Do you think there's any chance I know that off the top of my head? How long have you known me? Right?
Still one of my favorites. Still absolutely with Bobby Wagner, one of my favorite moments. And oh, what I miss just sitting by you, especially in those moments, like, you know, outside the studio. Yeah, Scott, so you guys are 21 and
that's not right.
So actually, they're 21 and 29. They're 8 games below 500 as we tape this podcast before they play in Baltimore.
Yes.
21 and 29. So it's not probably more bad than good. There is a lot more bad than good.
Yes.
To be 8 games under 500, one of the worst teams in the American League, right there with these Orioles who are perennially atrocious and in perennial rebuild, you're not supposed to be 21 and 29. So, yeah, bad. More bad than good.
Why? Why are we here? I mean, I talked to Jerry today, and I was kind of pointing the finger at a couple of specific players. I mean, look, you can blame a little bit of bad luck with Mitch Haniger, et cetera, but that's not enough. I mean, like, you had to be able to account for one major injury, right? I mean, that's just not enough to point at. The bullpen is completely imploded and not been even close to what it was a year ago. That's a big part of it. But if you're looking at, you know, at other guys, I mean, you know, you didn't get what you hoped for out of Kelnick, but don't you think that's been more than evened out by how much you've gotten out of Julio? Yeah. I would say it has. You've gotten more than you would have expected out of Ty France and J.P. Crawford. You've certainly gotten enough out of Eugenio Suarez. You've certainly gotten enough out of Frazier. I mean, he hasn't been terrible. He's been okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can kind of point at some of these names and be like, well, it's not like you're getting guy after guy that hasn't lived up to their billing. By the way, Logan Gilbert's been tremendous. Was arguably the best pitcher in the league in April, right? Marco's been mostly Marco. Maybe he hasn't been incredible. And Kirby's been pretty good since filling that spot. You're really looking at your bullpen, Jesse Winker, and Robbie Ray. Yes. That's basically the story of this team right now. And that it's amazing to me that, those three things would be enough to create this bad a problem.
Yes. But two of those in Ray and Winker were your two big acquisitions. Ray, your biggest financially, he was the Cy Young Award winner. He was not supposed to have an ERA around five and every other metric struggle. He was not supposed to have one inning every single game that implodes and makes you explode as you watch it and you scream at your television because they need him. They need that stopper. They need that ace. And you're right. I mean, Logan has picked up a bunch of those pieces. Kirby's been, I think, overall a pretty pleasant surprise, but man, why? So when you ask Jerry that specifically, he said, why Jerry, why are you 21 and 29 as we sit here?
Well, I didn't ask him that exact question, but I was asking.
Why wouldn't you ask him that exact question?
Sorry. Hey, if you want to come back and do radio every day, feel free. You can join me on these interviews. In the yes. meantime, you're going to have to deal with whatever I want to ask.
Yes.
Jerry, you know, we did specifically talk about, you know, Winker and Ray, and he said, especially in Winker's case, he's like, look, the guy didn't get bad overnight. Right? All the same skills that made him one of the best players in the league for the course of the last few, like, that hasn't changed. So he sees it as, you know, him putting extra pressure on himself. And,
yep.
you know, I know yep. you don't like the phrase trying too hard. And I don't think that's the right phrase for it. But feeling the weight of the expectations.
You absolutely feel that way. And we have watched it and watched it with plenty of guys where it just crushes them. It just, mm-hmm. it's just too much. Play in Cincinnati, play for in a hitter's park, play. And it's a good size market. It's a proud franchise, but they have not been competitive. And you can go out there and just kind of do your thing, go out there and produce, and the world doesn't notice you. Yeah, you come to a team that's contending. You come to a team that wants to win, that's got a lot of pieces around you, and you're supposed to be the guy with the 950 OPS that is the missing link, right? You're supposed to be part of the brilliant trade where you move some pieces and you acquire difference makers, not just Jags, not guys, but difference makers. Mm-hmm. And you've actually not been a difference maker. And in fact, your negative 0.7 WAR is as harmful as anybody on this team. You mentioned Ty France and JP Crawford. Those two guys have a combined WAR, wins above replacement, of 5.4. Ty has been phenomenal. 2.8, JP 2.6. Those two guys have exceeded, I mean, have outplayed any of their previous performance. They have been terrific. The entire rest of the team, Ty and JP are at 5.4. I added up the entire rest of the team, starting rotation, bullpen, every position player. This does not include Kelenic, so it would be even less than this because I believe he was negative WAR when he left. 5.4 for Ty and JP. 3.4 for the rest of the team.
Shush.
That's for the entire rest of, and I think Logan was almost a one. Mm-hmm. So he's almost a third of that. But 5.4 for JP and Ty, the entire rest of the team is 3.4 wins above replacement level.
And now you're players. Losing about almost 1.5 or more just from Winker and Castillo, right? I mean, I think if I saw it right, Castillo's a negative 0.9 and Winker's a negative 0.7. So when you start doing it, you know, that.
Correct.
And thankfully, Castillo's actually started to pick things up after a really horrible start to the season. You know, those two numbers certainly affect that. But I think the point is still very well taken, Brock, that outside of a couple of guys at the top who are exceeding, you've got a bunch of guys sort of at replacement level, sort of what you would naturally expect from them. And it's not that many guys who've been negative, but they've been so negative and were so counted on that it's really put you in a bind.
Yes. And it's just as a... It is a tough pill to swallow in a year of some expectations. Mm-hmm. I think that adds to it. If this was last year, I don't think you get this sense of frustration. I don't think players like Robbie Ray throw their glove, as Shannon reported, mm-hmm. you know, down the stairs of the dugout yesterday as he's leaving frustrated yet again to not be a stopper, to not win back-to-back games. I know they finally did that on a Friday and Saturday against Houston and hoped, okay, now go to Baltimore and go sweep this sucker, right? Just do it. And then not even to be competitive in a 9-2 loss is so infuriating, so much so that, you know, the Cy Young Award winner is displaying that as he throws his glove halfway down Baltimore.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, when you start off the way they did, the pressure is now starting to mount to deliver on that. and you've got to come up with sweeps. It can't just be winning two out of three. Like, at some point, you've sort of made your bed that you've got to kind of lie your way out of, right?
Yes. And, you know, on the flip side of that, by the way, the positive, remember, good and bad. Yep. Big, ugly mouth for Lynn Cobb, but man, sweet tasting because of the shrimp and crab they eat. All of that is bad. All of that is bad. I know you wrote an article in your COVID cave about this. The good is Julio.
Of course.
I mean, the good is the guy that just every time he steps in the box just explodes. The good is the guy that was on the big screen in the restaurant here at the Westmark in Sitka that turns everybody's head to see what he's going to do next. You know, I said a couple weeks ago on the podcast, the kids are going to be emulating his swing like I used to with Ken Griffey Jr. I fully believe that. I am not ready to crown him the next kid, but my goodness gracious, has he handled expectation? Has he handled early season adversity? Has he handled some of the pressure of teammates that are not supposed to be falling apart around him, falling apart, and in some cases being sent down to Tacoma? The dude is just unwavered and unwavering. And I'll tell you, the one that just sticks to me, Salk, is when that video of service with him before the season began, that's just going to, I think, continue to resonate, and hopefully forever, when he was like, hey, Julio, don't be anything different. Be who you are. And that joy you play with, you don't have to do a thing more. Be who you are and play with that joy. And man, what are we, 60 games into a disappointing season for a team? For him to be doing that is truly remarkable, man.
Is that more important than the success this year?
Of the overall team success?
Yeah. I mean, if Julio Rodriguez turns out to be everything he's supposed to be, is it... make it, I mean, not that it makes it okay, but does it balance out the challenges and the disappointment of where this year has gone? Because if Julio is that good, you mentioned that I wrote about this, I did, at seattlesports.com. If Julio's as good as he looks, the Mariners will make the playoffs. Maybe not this year, but they will make the playoffs. You don't get position players as good as that that don't make the playoffs. They all make the playoffs eventually. Honestly.
Well, the Angels of Mike Trout would be the one that you'd
he's
say.
Made it, and he's made it. I know he's only done it once, but he's been there. Okay. I mean, like, when you get players of that nature, of that ability, they make the playoffs.
Yeah. It makes it a little easier to put a supporting cast around them, too, just like it did with the kid. It made it a little easier to have the Jay Buhners of the world and the Edgar stick around and everybody else, because you want to be around that star. And we have seen that, and you're seeing that, obviously, in Toronto with Vlad Jr. and Chapman and the moves they make and people that come and play with him. You've seen that with Tatis. You've seen that in Atlanta with young superstars that are of a very similar ilk right now as to what Julio's doing, man. And, yes, it does counteract it. It doesn't make it palatable, though. It just doesn't. It doesn't erase the frustration of being 8 games under. It doesn't erase Winker. It doesn't erase Robbie Ray. It doesn't erase Kelenic. It doesn't erase, you know, just the bullpen. Diego Castillo. It doesn't erase it. It doesn't. Not this year. Maybe in years past, it would have been a little bit more palatable. Point of the horizon or the positivity or the future a little bit more. Not for me, Mike. Nope. This has just been frustration to turn this thing around, and for others to just look at Julio and go, gosh, he's a rookie. Come on, Winker. This guy's a rookie. You've got 5 years of service. You've been a 950 OPS guy. Just do your job. Come on, Robbie. You know, I'm not asking you to pitch shutouts, but I'm asking you to have an ERA around 3 and help this team win and avoid big innings, because your track record says you can and you should and you would, and why you were paid to get it done here. So, no, it doesn't totally offset it, but it does provide certainly a smile every time he's in the batter's box.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down 3 football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Saul.
All right, Brock, let's finish this up with a little Blue 88. We got a lot of football stuff to kind of cover and run through. So let me start here. Question number 1. As we talk through some of the differences in this Seahawks defensive system, specifically, you know, in their zone, which will be more of a matchup zone, what does that do for Jamal Adams? I mean, he's just that one guy where, you know, just waiting for them to get their full value out of it. How will he be affected by that change?
Well, he is going to have to cover a little better, and he's going to have to play from the neck up a little bit better. So when you pointed to your list of five different kind of characteristics there, struggles with the Ken Norton-led defense, and Jamal was right in the mix of that as a guy that was traded that had to wade through those waters for 2 years. You didn't necessarily hear him make these excuses, and I think in many ways he couldn't because he was beaten so badly in man coverage or beaten in a simple cover two over the top. So I don't think he's one that's got a lot of leverage from a coverage standpoint to be making a bunch of excuses. But this is going to be a step up. He played in a New York Jets system that just freed him, that just cut him loose. You go play around the line of scrimmage, you're a run stuffer, you're a blitzer, you're all over the place. Comes to Seattle, right, they kind of put him in the same kind of box everybody else, and then finally halfway through the season said, the heck with this, go. Go blitz, go pass rush, and he sets an all-time NFL record. Sacks for a secondary defender. Last year was a bummer for the entirety of this defense, as we documented. I think for this season, Mike, he is going to, even at this stage of his career, he's going to have to take an advanced step from the neck up. Coverage, pattern read, communication, talking. I don't think they're going to leave him on islands in man-to-man coverage. That's not playing to his strengths. But putting him around the line of scrimmage, right, covering some of the backs, covering some of the tight ends, covering in combo coverage with your linebackers, communicating. He, like everybody else, has got to fit in. It's not like, oh, yeah, we got a role for Jamal. He'll be just fine. We're just going to rush him 100 snaps like Benson Mayo did not do last year. Nope, that's not going to be the case. He's going to have to fit in and assimilate with everybody else, but I do expect to see him around the line of a scrimmage, just in that box, covering tight ends and backs a whole lot more.
Can he be more of a weapon? I mean, he's got to be.
Yes. Yeah. And he will be your blitzer, and he will be your disguiser, and he will be, you know, your run blitzer as well. He will be able to, I think, do some of those things. They will absolutely try to play to his strengths. And Mike, I sure hope he gets an opportunity to get some of his legs underneath him, right? That this is not a lost offseason as it is right now, that he can get into training camp and pass the physical because, yeah, he's got a lot of ground to make up. He's got a lot to learn. Even at this stage of his career, you don't just snap your fingers. See also the Seahawks and Ethan Posick and Russell Wilson last year. You don't just say, oh, yeah, I don't need the offseason. I don't need minicamp. I don't need training camp. Yes, you do. And Jamal certainly needs some of that.
All right, question number two. Brock, who has been there and who has been really shining as a great example for where the Seahawks need to be going?
Yeah, I think one of the most pleasant surprises of this offseason for me has been Tyler Lockett. Tyler was a guy that always loved to work. We watched him at training camp. He'd be at the OTAs. It wasn't as if he was not a part of it. But he was, I shouldn't say he was never. I don't know how much he loved being front and center and being the face. And you have seen him do an awful lot of that. You have seen him commit to flying and meeting Drew Lock in an off-season throwing session, an off-season workout. You have seen him front and center at Sports Star of the Year. You have seen him front and center in these press conferences. You see him at these voluntary OTAs wanting to be a part of it. And I know DK's got the star power. I know DK's an old-school number one wide receiver right on the outside that has just freaky, freaky traits. But there sits Tyler Lock. And I was looking at his numbers the other day, Mike. With a healthy season, he has a chance to be number two behind Steve Largent in a bunch of these statistical categories. It's Largent, it's Brian Blades, it's Doug Baldwin, and it's Tyler Lockett. As far as yards, touchdowns, receptions, he stays healthy. He's going to climb. He's never going to eclipse Steve Largent here. I don't think he has the longevity to do it, but he has a real chance to cement himself as the second greatest receiver in this franchise history, and I think he feels that, right? I think the absence of Russell and that void he is stepping into, and man, I am loving what I'm seeing from him this offseason.
Yeah, it's sort of reminiscent of the Bobby Wagner ascension after some of those other guys left, right? And all of a sudden, yeah, Bobby was the one at all the press conferences. And, you know, we talked to him about that. I had that conversation with him a few months ago where he talked about learning how to lead and going out and talking to and listening to other leaders that he respected and trying to figure out what that process was going to be like. I wonder how much of that Tyler Lockett will now go through as well, as we're seeing him sort of featured more front and center.
And he's got a new receiver coach, did an excellent job that I'm sure has challenged him. Hey, you and DK, right? And don't let this, oh, we don't have a quarterback, we don't have any. You two go and set the pace. You two go and prove that you're the best duo in the NFL. And if you can do it with Geno, you can do it with Drew Lock, you can do it with Baker, you can cement, I think, that argument that much more substantially, too.
All right, question number three, and we'll finish off here. It sounds like Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher kissed and made up, and everything's fine now, right? Everything's okay,
yeah,
hunky-dory?
Yeah.
Who got
yeah,
to
we're moving on, Mike. We're moving on.
The SEC? Who's the new SEC commissioner? It's not Mike Scott.
Mike, we're moving on.
What do you mean? Okay.
We're moving on. Okay. Greg Sankey is the commissioner, yes, and has been since Mike Slive stepped down from that position. And Greg Sankey got to Jimbo and got to Nick Saban and said, absolutely enough, you little toddlers, knock it off. So they had their first meetings, not even SEC media days, but had their first meetings in Destin, Florida this week. And it was clear, honestly, Jimbo Fisher went Bill Belichick. We're on to Cincinnati. Jimbo, I think, said that, I don't know, someone kept track of the tally. It's more than your vasectomy and COVID talk. And my second USFL, maybe the four of those things combined. But yes, Jimbo, I think, was told very clearly as far as their brand goes, Nick, for that matter, as well. Not good business. Not good business. Fun. It's fun to be in the headlines. Fun. Everybody got a little chuckle out of it. Fun to see the competitiveness. In the big picture, man, it is classic SEC stuff. They keep their stuff together, right? They bind their conference together better than everybody else. Mm. It's why they've succeeded the way they have. And not a surprise in Destin, and you'll see the same thing in Birmingham at SEC Media Days in July. They will all move right along.
There you go. That's a little Blue 88. So top.
Gosh, I feel like I need to bring you some soup. By the way,
that would be nice.
I feel like I need this, or some lingcod or halibut. Throw some rations down the stairs to you.
Top Gun was pretty good.
Man, it was. You haven't gotten to see that.
No,
yet, have
that's
you?
Been the biggest objection here to this problem. Is I can't get out to go see the movie, and I'd really like to. I'm all in, and Heather wants to go see it. I don't know. Maybe if I can test negative this weekend, I'll see if I can get out there and watch.
Please
but
It's awesome.
Everything I hear is that it's just an adrenaline rush, exhilarating, and that they just nailed it.
They did. They did in every way. Tied characters together, tied it back. It'd be worthy of a debate. I don't know if there's a better sequel in the history of movie making.
Well,
that's the debate you're going to have.
I think is probably.
I understand.
I mean, let's calm down.
Probably. I understand. That's the one that everybody points to, and that's
for
when it comes out of my mouth. Yep. I knew that that's where you were going to go.
Okay.
I think time and history will show that this one's going to hold its own, too.
All right. I love it. Brock, good stuff. Right. We'll do it again next week. For now, the hay
is in the barn.
See you, everybody.
Get to the chopper!